OpenStack is doomed, and it's all your fault.
In tech, we trust. Charge we're not sure about.
All right, welcome. It's episode 55 of the Entech We Trust podcast, and we're all on hardwired internet connections today. Nobody's on the road, not even Gabriel. How are you, Gabriel?
Oh, I'm great. Sorry. I thought I was on mute, and I'm like, I gotta find the mute button here, and I'm like doing three things at once, and I was reading a wind report, and you know, it's last day of the quarter. Last day of the quarter is always crazy, right? It's pushing to close deals, it's visiting customers, it's running around doing all the things you need to finish to get your MBOs in. You know, the last week of the quarter is just pure crazy. No matter what part of the sales team you're on,
no doubt. Hey, Gabriel, I want to ask you a quick question, actually. So you're looking to plan a podcast live from OpenStack Summit in Tokyo. I think, is it at the end of the month? Well, the end of next month, the end of October, yeah?
Yes.
So do you have any presentations or anything going on at OpenStack Summit, or are you just there for, like, leads and networking and stuff?
I'm just there to eat sushi and drink sake.
Nice.
No, I'm going to be... I have a couple presentations I'm giving. I'll be doing a bunch of customer integration, you know, lots of partner meetings, lots of customer meetings, presenting at the booth. I'll wear my bikini.
Please.
Yeah, it's dead sexy. Yeah. And then I have one tech talk that I'll do for V Brown Bag based on if hyperconvergence has a place in the OpenStack ecosystem. And then I'm recruiting people to do a live in Tech We Trust there. So I was going to talk to Scott Sanchez from MetaCloud and Blue Box Jesse, or Jesse Proudman from Blue Box, and possibly Ken Way from Platform 9 and Tyler Britton from Blue Box, and a couple others to see if we can do a little powwow around the state of managed OpenStack and the success that it's having in the ecosystem versus distributions. And maybe I might even be able to get somebody from Mirantis and Red Hat on as well, so we'll see.
You know what? You have got to pull that together, because that would be the business, I think.
Yeah, I think it'd be definitely – you know, from my personal viewpoint, I see it with our customers, because we have a lot of customers that are looking at things like MetaCloud from Cisco, and the flexibility of kind of bring your own hardware to OpenStack, and we're going to come in and manage for you and get you up to speed. There's a lot of appeal in the enterprise for that.
Cool. Well, I think on the tech news track on today's show, we're probably going to talk a bit about OpenStack anyway. So, Prodigal Son Returns, Rickatron.
How are you, fella? Oh, I'm broken, beat up, shaking around. It's the last time I've been on the show, friends. I've been on basically every continent except the one in which I live. It's been a crazy run in the last few weeks. I was in starting this month, I was in San Francisco for VMworld. Then I ran over to Israel for a Veeam event. And then I just came back from New Zealand and Australia for more Veeam events. I'm home for a week, but I leave for Asia on Saturday. Busy days for Rickatron. Man, it hurts.
Yeah, you got to clock some miles up there, though. That's some serious traveling.
I'd rather the miles just take me home, though. We don't get like premium cabin on the flight, so it ain't fun, bro, Chacho.
There's some long flights as well.
I know, ultra long haul is not fun in 34F. You know.
So. Oh, tell me about it. There was no my booked my ticket to Tokyo. There were no upgrades available at all. At least I got an aisle seat. But I'm back in like steerage. I feel like I'm like a third class on the Titanic.
Well, I mean, I got good status. So I get, you know, the premium economy with my airline. So that is good. You know, the 4 inches of leg room and the cover for your eyes. But
instead of one.
24 hours or whatever, like when I came back from Australia, that's just – there's no way to make that not long. There's just no way. And then – Asia, I go to Singapore and then Kuala Lumpur and then Hong Kong and then I'm back home. But, you know, there's no way to cut that Right. It's just long. But you know what? I actually enjoy the peace and quiet. I don't find myself very comfortable. You know, I like downtime. I love mental clarity. You know, I deflate and all, but...
What do you do to pass the time on those huge old long-haul flights then? Because it's not realistic to work, I don't think, in those kind of conditions.
No. New thing, right? I just switched over to T-Mobile for my personal cell phone, which is what I use for work, and I reimburse it. For one reason, unlimited international data. Second reason, in-flight texting is free on Wi-Fi with GoGo, at least on Delta, my airline, and domestically, including a lot of international flights. So I'm like flying home from Israel, and I'm texting my wife in-flight for free. That's a pretty awesome connectivity, I think.
It is, yeah. But I mean, texting's not going to pass the time.
That's
on, like,
true.
12-hour
that's
flight.
True. You know, I watch a few movies. You know what though? Don't get freaky on me. I just sit there and think sometimes, and that's actually just, I enjoy that. I'll sleep. I am able to sleep. I'll watch a little bit of TV, but I don't mind just sitting and thinking and trying some bad beer. I tried a new beer. I flew China Airlines from Auckland, New Zealand to Brisbane, Australia. I tried Taiwan beer. That's the name, Taiwan beer. It was okay. Do that kind of stuff. But no, it's good to be home for a bit.
Fair play. Okay, so we have a guest on this week because we've got no Farley, at least not at the moment. So Keith Townsend, welcome to the show, Keith.
All right. Thanks for having me on, guys.
It's a pleasure. You know what? We did try to have you on several weeks ago, didn't we, when we had that like hideous train wreck of a scheduling issue that actually, I think you said earlier, turned out to be a pretty decent show. So the pressure's on you, Keith, to add something special to the show this week.
Well, it'll be just like VMworld and getting called up to the V Brown backstage to do an improv talk on Batman, Superman, and your career. So hopefully it goes better than my planned. Just that went well. So hopefully it goes better than most of my planned talks. So that'll be great.
Well, we're looking forward to having you on anyway. So, Keith, actually, just for some of the listeners who maybe don't know who you are, just give us a quick rundown of who you are, what you do, where we can find you, how we can abuse you.
Well, first off, the Rickatron made me not miss consulting. That brutal flight schedule. I'm a reformed management consultant. I was traveling maybe 40 weeks out of the year, and Rick just reminded me of why I no longer do that. For the past year or so, I've been a infrastructure architect with a biopharmaceutical on the far north side of Chicago. And, of course, the blog is thectoadvisor.com. Do a bunch of stuff for Tech Republic, and of course you can find me on the Twitters at at CTO Advisor.
Cool. All right then. So guys, we've had some decent intros there. I think we need to really step straight into the tech news. So got a few things kind of cloud related and some OpenStack stuff, and then a bit of storage and other stuff later on in the biz news. But under tech news, right, so Rackspace, they look like they're about to start reselling AWS services and support, pretty much similar to what they're already doing for Azure. I think they're looking at alternative revenue streams because their public cloud offering is just not doing it for them these days. Sticking with public cloud, though, Microsoft's looking to bring a simple container service to Azure by the end of the year. So they're going to be building on Docker, Mesos, and Mesosphere DCOS tools. Sounds like it's a container frenzy out there. Couple of things around OpenStack, right? So first up, we've got what looks like to me at least, right, a NetApp and some other vendors are trying to drop some non-open source code into the OpenStack tree, and then in the latest release they've ripped it out, making you install it separately, as if like installing OpenStack wasn't hard enough already. At least I think that's my interpretation of the situation. Gabriel, you might have something to say on that in a second. But also there's an InfoWorld article out there, pretty damning piece actually, on some of the shortfalls of OpenStack. Now, I don't want this to be like, I personally don't want to sound like an OpenStack basher, because I've said quite a few times I really do want the project to succeed. But the InfoWorld article makes statements like, here's one here, OpenStack has serious issues related to complexity, scalability, and availability. And it quotes people as saying things like, the code base is a cauldron of competing products and a fair amount of poor quality code. Ouch.
Oh, that does hurt.
Yeah, that's the tech news for the week. I don't know if anybody's got anything they particularly want to talk about first, but that OpenStack piece to me is like, Oh, dear. I mean, we've talked a lot about the complexities of OpenStack in the past. Gabriel, I know you've got some opinions around managed OpenStack. I know you're quite positive about some of the offerings that are out there on that. Maybe you want to take the mic on that.
So, I mean, just based on my own experiences and what I saw, like when I was with Cisco, and then what I see now as, you know, working as a cloud architect at SolidFire, and I do work with some of the other, you know, groups who provide a managed OpenStack system. The enterprise, you know, they need a lot of handholding, I think, in many respects to get OpenStack up and running, unless they were very, very Linux oriented to begin with. I mean, I think that's one of the drivers, right? If you were a shop that was like 90% Linux or 80% Linux, or at least your core infrastructure was running on that, OpenStack wasn't nearly as daunting. But if you're like the typical Wintel shop, you know, you're looking at this going, what's a conf file? And then, you know, making all those different pieces of the stack work together. And it does take a fair amount of rocket scientists to get this up and running. And that's where the managed OpenStack platforms come in, and they can really shine because they can polish that. They can make it turnkey easy. They can get it up and running in a couple weeks. And, you know, I think a lot of people are still struggling to fully comprehend what OpenStack is in certain respects. I continue to hear people comparing it to, you know, to VMware and containerization and some of these other technologies, and that's not it. It's anybody who's, you know, anybody who used Amazon in their lifetime, AWS, and wanted that kind of experience in-house could go to OpenStack and do that. That's not a traditional replacement for full-blown standard infrastructure virtualization. And, you know, organizations who have workloads and have a mindset that have that kind of consumable approach, OpenStack is great for them. And that's not, you know, that's not everybody. But to have somebody come in and manage it for you and then possibly handed you the keys of the castle some point down the road, that's a transition point that enterprises can adopt, but makes it very difficult unless you're like a Walmart or an eBay to take that on yourself.
Can I just pick up on something there then, Gabriel? So I totally get, you know, that a lot of people do think it's a VMware replacement. And, you know, we've talked about that before, actually, and said, you know, it's totally not. But I liked what you said there. I think you seem to be suggesting that it's like an AWS, not an AWS ripoff, right? But it's maybe a vendor response to Amazon Web Services, right? Only it seems to me, right, that Amazon Web Services is pretty easily consumable by most people. The learning curve's not massive, right? But OpenStack, you know, is it? It's not actually making anybody's life easier at the moment, is it? I mean, even these companies that are, you know, full of Linux kernel engineers and Python developers and stuff like that can deploy it, is it really making their life any easier at the moment? Is the project at that stage yet?
I mean, I said that Vancouver was peak OpenStack in terms of buzz and investment and people getting up for it, and I think Tokyo will be interesting to see just because of the location, how that's a definitely a much more challenging place to go for a conference, but they still expect almost nearly as many people to go to Tokyo as they do Vancouver. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see the change over that 6 months in kind of the buzz and vibe. But, you know, I do see the need for an OpenStack platform in several types of organizations, infrastructure as a service, software as a service companies. They can totally take advantage of that. Service providers that are providing cloud services, managed hosting providers, they're all looking at it. And, you know, I look at it from my experience on a day-to-day basis. Half of the people I talk to are looking at or evaluating an OpenStack initiative. The other half are still doing traditional VMware-based virtualization. And, you know, and that runs a fairly broad spectrum of types of customers. I really do think, though, it's kind of the nature of where they're at in moving off of like ITIL and kind of those the things of the past, right? Once they've moved past that, they've kind of embraced Agile and DevOps to a certain extent, and there's not a lot of tools out there that aren't super costly and just equally complex that give them the flexibility of being able to do it. If I'm an organization that's delivering cloud native applications, right? Why am I going to go buy a out of the box software platform and pay a hefty fee for licensing and support when I have no control over the underlying code infrastructure? When I can go and invest probably man hours that are equal to that cost initially, but have complete and absolute control over the code base. And I think that it's the companies that are looking at it from that approach as to why they would go the open source route versus the closed route.
Sure.
Well, one thing to add, you know, Nigel, you drew the AWS comparison. I'd add that, you know, that persona, I think, you know, from who I talk to, depends on what people are looking to do. And what I mean by that is, do they use AWS for one little thing over here, or are they using AWS type of, you know, that whole full cloud stack for a lot of things and applications connecting to each other? If it's one thing where, well, I just send a little bit of data up to S3 object storage, that's not really a very advanced use case. But if I'm building things around Elastic Beanstalk and all these other services they have, that's a much more sophisticated model, and that's the type that, in my opinion,
it is. And you know, those kind of customers are they're not the traditional enterprises. They tend to be smaller companies, and they tend to be building born in the cloud apps, if you will. So I have been working with a company. They're deploying to AWS using Elastic Beanstalk, all that kind of stuff. But they've got no legacy, if you know what I mean. They're like a new company that's just bidding for contracts here, there, and everywhere, all that kind of stuff, and deploying a new app. Totally not that traditional kind of Wintel shop that's got 1,000 different apps out there supporting their own internal IT and all of that. So, I don't know. I still struggle to see, you know, normal enterprises that we're all used to working with. I'm saying we're all used to working with. I'm struggling to see those guys have a proper use case for something like OpenStack at the moment. I still do think that they're wanting to kind of fudge their old infrastructure on. Mm.
No, I'm saying the same thing for Docker.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
It's, I think the ecosystem that's capable of executing with those technologies is 10x smaller than the groups that can do it on OpenStack. But yet, look where all the buzz is. Look at where all the hype is, the investment. And I'm not sure if that's so much hedging a bet on the future of where they think things may go, or it's just following the excitement.
I think, Gabe, you hit on a pretty important key point earlier, and Nigel asked the original question, you know, does OpenStack make your job easier? I don't think it's making anyone's job easier, just like assembly didn't make anyone's job easier when you were programming straight to hardware. It makes it makes you, the organization, capable of doing things they couldn't do before. And for organizations that can find a use case for being able to do something they couldn't do before, then OpenStack makes sense. Just like Docker or Kubernetes or any other new cloud native application makes sense for organizations looking to do things that they couldn't, or it was even more painful to use different solutions other than OpenStack, Kubernetes, Docker, or whatever to do before. So for organizations such as Comcast that can throw the dollars, or Walmart that can throw the dollars in developers and the IP at those solutions, I think they're reaping the benefits.
There was a great article on NewStack that my boss, Aaron Delp, gave me that talks about how the enterprise adopts NewStack. And it's funny because it gives you the 8-year process, how they identify how companies, you know, the startups are doing all this cool stuff and they're moving forward and what like that. And it's this kind of like hierarchy of slow adoption and acceptance. And then they get to like year 8 and it says, all right, look at year 1 again. And it's this horrible enterprise IT adoption cycle, right? Because they're so slow to adopt this stuff. And I think we're kind of in year 4 or 5 OpenStack.
I talked to a enterprise manager just the other day, and he said, you know what? VMware has this really cool service called vCloud Air. I just heard about it for the first time like 2 weeks ago. Is it new? And that's the pace of enterprise IT.
It is, yeah. Hey, Keith, so where you were working now, or maybe in where you've worked in the past, have you seriously taken a look at things like OpenStack and Docker?
So I did an introduction to OpenStack internal presentation maybe about 2 months ago to an organization with about 150 engineers. I got maybe 3 people to attend it. There's just no interest, even from the geek level, for it in large enterprises. If it's not directly affecting their day-to-day job, most engineers really don't care. So if it's not coming from executive level folks, during my management consulting days, heard about it in passing, but no one really seriously thinking about OpenStack on a enterprise. When I say enterprise, I mean Fortune 50, 500 CIO, CTO level. There weren't a whole lot of people talking about it at that level.
Okay. Anybody talking about Docker?
Plenty of people talking about containers. Containers, I think, and I think that, you know, again, it goes to the audience. Developers get containers. Developers create applications. Developers have the power in enterprise IT, and it's going to get a lot more interest in infrastructure-facing technology like OpenStack.
Yeah, you know, I think as well, maybe one of the key differences between something like Docker and OpenStack is that Docker certainly makes developers' lives easier. I mean, it doesn't necessarily make sysadmins and IT ops lives easier. In fact, I'd say in a lot of cases, it probably makes it quite a bit harder because we don't have all the tooling around how to orchestrate and manage container-based environments, and developers tend to go off and do their own thing under the radar as well. But maybe that's a key difference there between containers and OpenStack is that, you know, yes, they both potentially enable organizations and people to do things they haven't been able to do before, but Docker actually makes developers' lives easier. And it, you know what, as a project, it's a lot simpler than OpenStack as well. OpenStack is, well, it is that cauldron that we mentioned earlier of competing products and potentially poor code. Anyway, let's move on to the business news. So I think I've got one, two, three, four things here. So apparently, right, the Pure IPO could be as early as next week. They reckon it's not common these days to file your S1, at least with the numbers in it, until you're literally ready to rock and roll. Now, a question I'm going to have, and maybe we can come to this after I've gone through the other couple of items, but could Pure actually afford to go much longer? You know, could they afford to wait until next year to IPO? But let's park that. EMC's DSSD division, apparently they've acquired or are acquiring a stealthy ultra-low latency storage startup called Graphite Systems in what surely, right, can, I guess at this late stage, only be a talent and patents acquisition, because I think we're expecting to see product along the DSSD lines in maybe the next 6 to 12 months is what I've been reading. And I love this one, right? So apparently HP are being sued by the state of Michigan for like $33 million plus a few odds and ends because they've been trying for 10 years to replace a legacy mainframe system that was supposedly built originally in the 1960s. I mean, I love stuff like that. Yeah, and we've got one final last piece, and I've not actually scribbled this down, but NetApp, they've gotten a new CTO, is that right? Who is that? I can't even remember who it is, shocking of me. Where are we? Oh, Mark Bergman, new CTO. So I don't know the details on this, but he was at Symantec Veritas up until 2011, but I don't know where he was in between then and now. So anyway, changes on the front for NetApp. But the Pure IPO, right, potentially as early as next week. Anybody got any thoughts on whether they could last much longer anyway at the way that they're or at the rate that they're burning cash on marketing and the stuff?
You read the article, it makes it seem dire like they had to IPO now. But I think market conditions are probably more favorable right now than they are in the future. And if you have the opportunity to go, you go. I mean, that's just kind of my read on it. I don't think there's any big. I mean, you look at their numbers; it's like, you know, they're gaining momentum. You know, they had some, you know, tough quarters there, but if you look at it, they're closing the gap significantly. In this, like, what was it, 12.5% revenue, or whatever it was? Because I'm just bad at math. The trend is upward for them, and I think that, you know, you strike while the buzz is hot, the iron's hot, and that's what your investors want. If they hold out for longer, what do they gain? You know, do they get a more favorable share price? Well, that's going to come anyway if their trajectory is still on the upward trend. So, you know, you can get in at a price point, what, $16 to $18 a share, which isn't crazy. I mean, if they came in at $120 a share, people would be like,
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not like real humans are going to trade their stock anyway. It's going to be all robots. So.
Sure, yeah. I mean, yeah. I guess the only thing could be if they were looking to post better quarter results in the future. But like you say, that can come anyway.
Why not come in a little lower and then post those quarter results and boom, you get a nice pop for the people who did buy the stock. And then now you have a momentum trend.
Yeah. I guess you're keeping a particularly close eye on this, Gabriel, working in a similar – industry. Well, the same industry, obviously, but similar product portfolio, that kind of stuff. Everybody seems to have their eye on this Pure IPO, don't they? Because we've had some not so good IPOs in the storage space in the past. This is a real marquee one, though, yeah?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you look at Violin and Fusion.io as kind of the last two somewhat infrastructures. And then you have Nimble, which has done fine. You know, they've done well. I mean, they've not blown the doors off anything. But I also think that their market penetration rate is, you know, indicative of where their stock's sitting at. So, you know, they're not going to be a $20 billion company. And I don't think Pure will be either. That said, you know, everybody in the infrastructure market that's a startup is watching this very closely, because if it does really well, that bodes well for them. It bodes well for SolidFire. It bodes well for Nutanix and Simplivity and, you know, Tintree and Tegile and a whole bunch of other companies. If it lays a big egg, you know, my thought is that, well, guess what? Nobody's going to get any more funding in that space.
Well, you know, I've got an interesting observation, though. I'm reading a blog on the Wall Street Journal, which for that type of stuff I actually trust. Listen to this quote from about Pure Storage. They had great growth of 308% from 2014 to 2015, but during that time frame, the losses mounted. The company states risk factors in the regulatory filing, quote from the filing, "We have not achieved profitability for any fiscal year since our inception."
Dun, dun, dun.
That's every startup.
Well, not mine, just for the record.
Right, but how long have you been? Scary. Yeah, I mean, you've been in the market a little bit longer, and you're not an infrastructure play.
That's true.
You're software. I think that there's a big difference.
There's a huge difference, but
right.
I don't know. It just doesn't feel right. It feels dirty. Not being...
Well, I know if I had money to invest, I asked the question, why would I have invested in any infrastructure hardware company at all, other than something that had something that HP or Dell or somebody would want to buy? And I just don't see the long term for any of these guys, Violin, Pure, any of them. That's just, you know, me personally.
There's going to be, you know, I think in me and a few other people kick this around over beers and whatever, the great consolidation is coming in the next 24 months, where you're going to see a lot of these companies we've been talking about for the last 5 years either be acquired or die. Because it's just not – they're at that maturity cycle in their funding where if they can't IPO and if they can't get any more money and they've never turned a profit, then what happens? They shrink their staff. They become an acquisition target for IP only for the most part, or some of the technology to bring in, because otherwise it's like you can't keep going, you know.
I'm just not seeing where a lot of these companies can go, that's all. I mean, all the big boys tend to have closed the holes in their portfolio. If it was like a couple of years ago, you know, and all the big three-letter vendors and the likes hadn't already plugged those gaps in their portfolio, it was kind of rosy back then. There were a lot of options on the table. Whereas now, I don't know. I mean, you say picking them up for IPO and for talent and for IP and for talent and stuff like that. Fair enough, but that's not a good end, is it? You know, you don't make a lot of money being picked up just for your IP and your talent, generally speaking. I mean, let's be honest. There's still a limit on the number of products EMC can have in their storage portfolio. I mean, they've already got about 50,000, but I don't think they can keep adding.
After HP buys them, you'll have to cut that in half too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But that's the flip side, right? You get to a certain point where you need to keep growing and keep expanding and keep doing more at the expense of your past investments. I mean, look at the VMAX and Symmetrix platform. And what do we got, 25 years on that stuff? Obviously, you have to start strategizing in the longer term. And I'm sure there's data scientists and people with like that know math.
Yeah.
You know, in economics, that can look at this and say, at what point is it optimal to start making that move? They're not rolling dice. They're not, you know, or looking at bones or tea leaves or anything like that. They actually make, you know, very cognizant decisions based on a lot of analytical data that's going to help assist them. So maybe that's the move why you bought Xtreme.io when you did. You bought DSSD, even though they didn't have any customers or a product, really, when they did. You bought this intellectual property. It's setting yourself up for that next generation of technology that's 3 years down the road before it starts to sit or even see basic common adoption. and it bridges the revenue stream from those old legacy platforms that are going the way of the Dodo.
Hey, here's a random question then, right? So you talked about Symmetrix and 20, 25 years, however many years that's been going as an architecture. And don't get me wrong, right? I totally get that the switch to Intel-based architectures when they switched to VMAX and porting all the code and stuff. I'm not saying that Symmetrix is a 20-year-old dinosaur, right? But do you think the days of, you know, a solid technology platform like Symmetrix and others out there living for 20-plus years, do you think those days are behind us? Or do you think any of the new crop, like maybe, you know, your own technology there, Gabriel, or a Pure or whoever, right? Do you think they've got the legs to last, or do you think the world's changed? And that's open to everybody, right?
I'm seeing the cycles for hardware come down in the enterprise. The depreciation companies are going from a 5-year depreciation schedule to 3-year depreciation schedules and 3-year leases. I think organizations are looking to become more agile and being able to dispose of and pivot on technology platforms as needed.
Well, I know why they're getting rid of those 5-year depreciation cycles, because I tell you what, whenever you buy, especially storage hardware, you tend to get 3 years maintenance thrown, well, not thrown in, but you know what I mean? As soon as you hit years 4 and 5, good grief, the costs go through the roof. So I think people are becoming savvy to that. Actually, though, do you think that's maybe a trend towards people moving away or moving towards more OPEX type models?
Like a lease of an array or something like that?
Maybe, yeah.
Well, I'm seeing an awful lot of, and this is going back to my consulting days, I'm seeing a lot of companies lease VMAXes for 3 years or that quality of storage, and not just storage, but compute as well. They've shifted a lot of that CapEx to OpEx, and I think it's a couple of different reasons. One, the OpEx expense for whatever their situation is a little bit more appealing, and then two, from a technology perspective, some of the directors I've talked to want the flexibility to pivot on platform if needed. They like that power of that negotiation power when they're talking to the HPs, Dells, and EMCs of the world.
Yeah. Just on the topic of Pure again, right? I know this is rumor and speculation, right? But maybe linking it into the DSSD piece, there's talk as well. I mean, Rick, you just talked about the Wall Street Journal article there saying, you know, they've never drawn a profit yet, or they've never made a profit yet. If they're potentially sinking R&D dollars into something that competes with DSSD and, you know, proprietary memory form factors and proprietary ultra low speed interconnects and things like that, I still can't get my head around the whole idea of that. It seems to me that on one hand, right, we're trying to move away from those kind of Symmetrix and Hitachi VSP type architectures, you know, where the hardware is like, I'm picking numbers out of the air here, right? But 5 years in the designing and the software is tightly tied to it. You know, the two are married at the factory and can never be used separate from each other. And all of these like custom ASICs and FPGAs and things like that in there. We seem to be, you know, moving away from that, but then on the other hand saying, oh right, well, you know, that whole commodity off the shelf stuff, it's great, right? But let's go and make proprietary memory form factors and, you know, these ultra low speed interconnects and stuff like that. And I get it from like a technology and from a hardware perspective, and kind of the geek inside me loves it, but that's, I just still can't get my head around how it seems to be against the market trend at the moment.
You know, I think that there's a specific vertical where the custom,
I know,
buyer,
but how big and how much money is in that? I just, well, is it worth?
Well, if you look at just the high frequency trading industry alone, who will swap out complete component characteristics in 6 months?
And yeah, but it gives them a 2% performance improvement.
If it's five more microseconds of latency,
yeah,
right. And, I mean, they can do the cost analysis to determine what that looks like, you know, and that's the extreme example. HPC is somewhat similar, though. I think that they try to attempt at getting better, you know, more longevity out of their platforms. But I mean, we had a customer just today that had an investment in another flash player that they'd only had for a year, completely drop it completely. Because they saw that they can make And one, their ROI was like 8 or 9 months. But secondly, they saw that they could actually make money on the platform based on how we had modeled something for them. And it's like, all right, if I can make one additional dollar over the other things that I had, that's one additional dollar to my bottom line. And then there's a potential to have a larger, stronger revenue stream. People are going to do it. If it takes custom hardware to do that, that's where you're seeing kind of this weird resurgence in some aspects of FPGA technology.
Yeah.
And Intel, people investing heavily in stuff like Altera, a consolidation of, Avago buying Emulex and some of these other companies that make silicon. Because they're going to take that technology and leverage it someplace into either custom stuff or commodity, and they're going to have a nice hybrid approach for both because there's a market where you can actually tap both.
And then there's the market for risk aversion as well. I've had the frustration of trying to convince a customer that they didn't need two VMAXs for a single application, not for their data center, but for a single application.
Is it for Notepad?
It was for the new Apple Notepad, actually. So it was a little bit more robust and justified. But, when their whole application budget is $330 million, spending $5 million on storage and for a peace of mind really isn't that big of a deal.
But it is a big deal, if you get what I'm saying there.
Yeah, it's a big deal. But yeah.
Right. You're not going to make that on, you're not going to make your money on that 90%. You're going to make it on the 90% that spends $1 million on, or sub $500,000 or $500,000 to $1 million a year in their IT spend. You're going to make it on the company that sells, $2.5 to $10 billion a year on their IT spend. But also when you're dealing with somebody like that, keep in mind that they tend to be price setters in certain respects. They definitely get much larger discounts, and the mathematics behind the margins that are in those types of sales are definitely far different. They're not going to pay. No one's paying MSRP at that level.
Yeah, you're going to probably get a free storage array out of the deal compared to other customers.
Just wait till support comes around, though.
You don't get free support though.
All right, then should we wind the show out with them? Rick, you've got something to say around this whole Michigan thing with HP not being able to replace the mainframe. Now, I don't know whether the mainframe in this case was actually implemented in the 1960s and they can't replace that, or if the comment is that mainframe technology in general is from the 1960s. Either way, right? I mean, a 10-year, a 5-year project apparently that they've been working on for 10 years to replace a mainframe, and they've not been able to do it. How can you not laugh at that? I don't want to bash on HP because we've done a bunch of that in the past, but come on.
Now, a lot of thoughts on this, guys. So PC World has an article about it's a mainframe-based system that processes vehicle registrations in the state of Michigan. I used to live in Michigan, for those who don't know the full history of the Rickatron. In fact, number one on my list of top 5 dream jobs for the Rickatron is, believe it or not, governor of Michigan.
What?
seriously, man, look it up. Anyways, but
don't they all go to jail?
No, that's Detroit. That's
Illinois.
Illinois. Yeah, that's a
Those are big city mayors. Come on. That's not governors. Okay, anyways. So and this is particularly irritating, right? And what I mean by that is, government technology is a different business. I don't know if you guys have ever gotten involved with that at any level. And even in other countries, I've had – it's just an interesting discussion. But this particular element of the state of Michigan's IT infrastructure, like I said, does vehicle registrations. It's based on a mainframe app from the 60s. The HP contract was to modernize it by 2010. And here we are looking at my clock, 2015, not done. Millions of dollars in, 5 years late, the state of Michigan not happy. Now, here's why I think Michigan is in the right. They're really pushing to modernize the app. I get that, right? Now, a couple years ago, there's a website, govtech.com. They do like awards for, government technology. And actually a couple years ago, it's not the 2015 awards, but Michigan actually won first place on that. you know, Michigan has a very large tourist industry. The Great Lakes are a true gem in this country if you guys haven't been there. But you've got this like sore thumb, this like scar about the vehicle registration, right? So that state invests very well in, you know, government web technology and other technology, but this element is not doing so good. So, the state's doing the right thing, and they've picked a household name, HP, to get it done. They've put a lot of money on the table to get it done, and they're 5 years late, and it's not done. So I'm siding with the Wolverine state here. Now, a couple more interesting points here is that this aggressive approach by the Secretary of State, you know, it's not our choice to go to court, but we have to protect the taxpayers. And you know what? They cannot just bleed municipal money. You know, think about it that way. You're talking about tax money. Corporations, a little bit, you know, more flexible.
I'm pretty sure they've done a pretty good job of bleeding taxpayer money.
Well, maybe, but they got to draw a line somewhere, and I think it's an unfortunate step, but I think that this is what needs to happen. And here's the part that really gets me, and I'm going to quote the PC World article. Following months of negotiations, Michigan issued a termination for cause letter on the 28th, but that contract still requires that HP must provide support for up to 270 days after the termination of the contract. But that staff has not reported to work since August 31, 2 days after that termination for cause. So think about it that way. I mean, these are big agreements. These are complicated contracts. This is tough business, and I'm going to side on HP on the state of Michigan with this, because you know there's got to be a way. There's a lot of money on the table, and you know, the state's not happy. So I'm on the side of Michigan with this.
I worked for Lockheed for a couple of years. And let me tell you, working for the U.S. government as a contractor had to be one of the most frustrating experiences in my life. Government is most definitely not a technology. When it gets to this point, it's not a technology problem. It becomes a people and process and change problem. And trying to be, the government does a good job of finding outside contractors and trying to be an agent of change. But my experience has been for things like this, it's normally not the technology or the vendor that's incapable of making the transition. I'm sure HP has helped hundreds of companies with this type of transition. It becomes a issue of just people and government bureaucracy getting in the way. It's been my experience.
Oh, not going to doubt that is legit. That is it's kind of like when I used to do work out of the country. You know, those who know me know that I used to work in the supply chain industry, and what would take me 3 hours, you know, in Indiana takes me 2 weeks in Venezuela, that type of stuff. So I get where you're coming from, Keith.
Hey, I got a true story for you here, right? So quite a few years ago, I worked on a government contract over here in the UK, the contractor that won the contract subbed out part of the work to the company that I was working for, right? And we implemented a solution, and we had some ridiculous SLAs, okay, that we weren't meeting. And according to the contract, if we didn't meet the SLAs, they didn't have to pay us. And that was obviously a sticking point for the company I was working for. We needed paying. So we were suggesting and we were trying to raise changes to implement fixes that would enable us to meet the SLAs. But of course, as soon as we met the SLAs, they'd then start having to pay. And no word of a lie, they just made it impossible for us to implement those changes, because it was not, I mean, the service was actually working for them, but we weren't meeting the SLAs, even though it was good enough, right? We weren't meeting the ridiculous SLAs that we'd signed up to, but they didn't care because it was working, and they didn't have to pay us. And, you know, that kind of thing is not uncommon when you get into these big contracts and you've got lawyers and legal departments involved in drawing things up, and there's big money involved. I get that it gets ugly. You've kind of just taken the shine off it for me though, Keith, because I was kind of, you know, liking the idea that good old mainframe was irreplaceable as a technology. But, you know, to be honest, the reality of it is probably its process and its bureaucracy and stuff like that rather than tech.
Yeah, there's a reason why HP is cutting, you know, 25,000 to 30,000 jobs in that former EDS division. I had to compete against those guys, and there's no way I would ever win and worked for that group. It is a tough, tough business.
Yeah. You got to be like a parent of like 10 kids. You got to have the ultimate patience to do that.
Mm-hmm. You know what? HP are having a torrid time at the moment as well. I mean, this isn't the first time that they've been sued for a lot of money over similar things to this, and there's all the job cuts going and stuff. Man, it's got to be brutal if you're there at the moment. Wish everybody the best over at HP. I hope that, you know, they're one of the great companies, you know. They epitomize, you know, the early days of Silicon Valley and everything, really. I'd love to see those guys turn it around, to be fair. And I think they've made quite a lot of long-term plays in the white box networking space, and you know that HP Helion cloud based on OpenStack that we talked about earlier, that could come good for them in the future. Who knows?
Yeah, I went to their customer event a few months ago and walked away just really impressed from a pure technology perspective. 3PAR is a good platform. The machine, the work, their research development team is doing is really, really interesting stuff. So HP, I'm pulling for them. One, I'm a major customer there, so I want them to do well. And two, I think the industry needs a strong HP.
Do you think the splitting off of the two divisions of the company is going to be a long-term positive?
I think it will be a long-term positive. I wish they could kind of get rid of autonomy and that headache as well. But that would be – and also, you know, EDS is I'll use the proper name. HPES is dragging them down as a company. I wish they could have bought my former company, PwC, when they had the opportunity. HP would be a very, very different company at this point.
Well, we're getting towards not far off an hour of recording, gents. So does anybody have anything else to wrap the show up with?
I'm good.
No, I mean, it's been a good conversation. Keith, you know, thanks again for joining us. I know that we were not able to squeeze you in the last time, and glad we were able to finally get you on the show.
I really appreciate you guys having me. It's been like listening to the show, but I'm here, which is weird.
There you go. Yeah, well, thanks again for being on, Keith. Rick and Gabriel, pleasure as always, gents. And everybody, thanks for tuning in and listening.